Hey, Damon. How's it going?
It's going fine. How are you, Rack?
I'm pretty good. I'm holed up in the sixth floor of an apartment in New York City, looking out over a very grim skyline.
Could be worse.
Feeling good.
Glad to hear it. Well, I appreciate your making time for this. It should be a lot of fun.
Oh, brother, I appreciate all the efforts you've been going to and helping you know, support this film. It's amazing.
Least I can do. I really think people need to know about this. I mean, it's a potential life changer for people. So, lots of questions for you. To start with, Rack, maybe you could just tell me a little about what people can expect from this film screening next month.
Well, the Santa Cruz film screening is going to be quite a beautiful little event, I hope. It's at the Pacific Cultural Center, and we're doing it in concert and in partnership with MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. We've got a few confirmed guests, like David J. Brown, who's a local commentator on psychedelic and entheogenic issues. And also, I'm very pleased to announce one of the, I guess you'd say one of the stars of the film, or one of the characters, the strange shamanic figures that are in the film, Dr. Juan himself, is in the Santa Cruz region and has agreed to participate in the panel discussion and basically talk about some of the very provocative material we showed in the film with the 5-MeO-DMT brainwave experiments that we did at the Rose and Sita at Ron Willock's house. And it's one of the questions I get quite a lot from the film. It is pretty much an energetic sort of climax of the film. And, you know, it's quite unique. I do feel there's not much comparable to that scene in cinematic history, really. There's been some films, maybe like The Fountain, which, while, you know, a mainstream Hollywood film sort of clothes covers some sort of psychedelic issues or sort of energetics behind it. But that scene and what we were trying to do there of anchoring for the audience to take them on that journey into the deep, you know, reaches of the Godhead and the 5-MeO white light tunnel sort of mystic experience. That is something we'll talk about with Dr. Wan, who has the MRI EEG output. He has all the brain scans and he has the data sets, and he can talk about the relevance and what we can bring back from that experience.
Oh, that's true.
So we'll also have some MAPS staff and practitioners on hand to talk about their work with, medicalization of psychedelics and bringing this into the mainstream paradigm. And we will have the film, and we will have myself there as well. So it should be a really rollicking good night, I hope.
I think so. So, I do want to talk with you at length about the scene at La Rosacita. First, I want to get into the part about the vision of the jaguar, which is another one of my favorite parts of the movie. You're one of so many people who has seen this, who has encountered a jaguar on ayahuasca. What do you think this jaguar is that so many people see?
Look, there's many, many ways we could approach this. From a Western psychological paradigm, they look at the hallucinations experienced under entheogens or psychedelics as projections of our own subconscious. I think there may be something to that, but maybe not in the way that mainstream sort of psychology understands. It seems to me that in the ayahuasca experience, and from what they can tell from the brainwave sort of mapping of what occurs, it seems to be that a lot of the healing which goes on is because people revisit their psychological trauma or their buried emotions or their wounds, their shadow material, as Jung would call it. And it gets revisited and it gets disassociated, and we get to let go of those imprints and those things we store within us. On the same level, I feel that when you under the influence of ayahuasca, it's been proven scientifically in the one main study done in the early 1990s, the Ayahuasca Project, that it actually sort of relinks up neuronal activity and brainwave activity. I was actually just speaking to a very, very interesting woman just yesterday who lives in Canada, who was in a very severe car accident and was basically brain damaged in a severe state. They said she was basically a vegetable, basically wanted to switch the whole thing off. She was bedridden for 3 months and discovered ayahuasca basically in a dream. And then, you know, friends of hers were saying, well, that sounds like ayahuasca. She thought it was like some brown coffee thing. She kept seeing these visions of the jungle when she was, you know, bedridden for 3 months. When, part of her recovery process, she managed to get to Peru. and to take the medicine. She's had not a complete recovery, but an amazing recovery to such a degree. And it's so what it's doing to the brain, it's relinking the neuronal activity. It's defragging the neuronal activity on that level. On a deeper level of a Jungian type of analysis, the idea that dreams are day residues and we encounter people and objects and things that we're thinking about in our conscious mind, that was level one. Level two was the collective unconscious. Level three, and who knows how deep this actually goes, but beyond the collective unconscious of humans, I believe that what nature has done by threading the neurotransmitter DMT throughout pretty much, as far as I can see, all her sentient creatures, and that includes the plants, the insects, the mammals, the toads, it's throughout all these species which have some degree of sentience. And so there seems to be perhaps a collective species unconscious where all these things overlap. So what I'm getting to with the jaguar is potentially these other animals either could overlap beyond the Western mainstream medicalization of the understanding of what's going on. It could be perhaps that these other creatures, like the jaguar, dominates the physical jungle. Perhaps it has some type of, territorial sort of battling going on in the astral jungles. We do know there's some famous BBC footage of jaguars nibbling and shredding, like I mentioned in the film, the yahe plant or the ayahuasca vine itself. So these animals are also drawn to these plants and to these states of mind. There's all of that, and then another cosmovision from a Peruvian angle would be that the jaguar is considered the ally, a very powerful ally, because it can kill and it's so ruthless and it's so clever. It's such an intelligent creature. I was once told by one curandero, Don Juan, that he's had many examples where entire villages deep in the Amazon have been terrorized by jaguars, and they basically have to completely leave the village and not go back because people who stay get stalked at night, and the jaguar will come in the hut. And sometimes it will sort of play with the people over many nights, or it won't kill them, and then it'll toy with them, and, in the morning everyone will be dead. It's like the jaguars are very powerful avatars who have a feline form, but in the indigenous cosmovision they understand that all these sentient creatures are competing in the web of life and in the physical jungles and the astral jungles, and that's why they befriend them on the astral level. So these energetic avatars with so much power of the jaguar, that could be another reason why they appear so often, is that they're very powerful shamanic avatars and perhaps they're patrolling the astral jungles.
If that's true, then, I mean, was there any fear on your part when you encountered it of being killed? Maybe in the astral sense.
I must say, in the physical experience and in the emotional and astral experience as documented in the film, it's taken from a chapter of the book called, in the book it's called Cosmovision, but in the film we call it Two Jaguars. At that time I was heavily inebriated in the ayahuasca trance, and I was seeing, first level bardo geometric DMT sort of entry point material, and vomiting profusely into the porcelain toilet at the time as that morphed into eyes and as that morphed into this entity, this real presence of a jaguar spirit. So at the time I was torn myself between ego dissolution and some sort of genetic memory throwback into this avatar of the jaguar who, as it evolved, as the vision evolved, revealed itself as me, it was vomiting too. So it's a complicated scenario, but there was less fear than more awe and more sort of respect for this creature.
Fair enough. Now, you also had that prophetic lucid dream about a jaguar just a couple of weeks before you went to the Amazon for the first time. So along those lines, I was wondering what you think of the idea that the brain might release more DMT than usual during lucid dreaming, and that in that sense lucid dreams are a kind of DMT trip.
Yeah, I think that's actually been taken up by some neuropsychologists already, and that is these things, neuroscience is still evolving and they're still getting the finesse to actually drill deep into these uncharted territories, but that is one of the points that has been raised, and that seems to be they conjecture that Dr. Rick Strassman, who did the DMT spirit molecule tests in the 1990s, the only legal tests, that have been done at at that time or since, he did note that everyone has different quantities of DMT endogenously occurring in their brain. It's in their cerebrospinal fluid, you know, it's in our lungs, it occurs all in different parts of the body. But when measured, some people have higher quantities of DMT than others. Now, you know, they've been looking into the connection between DMT and schizophrenia and things like that, that perhaps people are just the sensitives, the people who would be chosen as the shamans in cultures which have a shamanic tradition. In the West, you know, they're called mentally disturbed and medicated. But these people probably do have high levels of DMT and can induce a visionary state or are paralleling. You know, it's very interesting because if this was a virtual reality, we would call it augmented reality. But here, it's in a shamanic sense. You know, it's either madness or it's mysticism. But so yeah, people have different levels of DMT. It's highly proven that it's sometimes it means in the test that Rick Strassman did that some people needed enormously high doses of DMT injected in them to get anywhere because they had such a high baseline to begin with, where other people were very sensitive to amounts that were added. And so the idea about lucid dreaming and going into dreaming, yes, it does seem that there's probably, that's a good chain of exploration there because there does seem to be lucid dreaming. When I had that dream, though, I must say it was just an average night, whatever, but I think what happens, and for me, what my understanding, entheogens in general, as well as being ego-dissolving, they don't just dissolve ego or personality, they seem to dissolve linear time-space. So sometimes we seem to be enmeshed or dissolved into basically the web of life, basically into a non-linear distributed consciousness, which may or may not be the frequency of nature herself on that tryptamine level. And so time is actually happening at all times in that distributed consciousness. And the organism of the earth is evolving from what we consider the past to the future, but it's all one hyperdimensional object which has existed, does exist, and always will exist to some degree in its lifespan. And so for me to have that prophetic dream weeks before I went to Peru makes a lot of sense because basically it's connected to that moment in time, but all those points are connected because space-time is one organism. Like, you know, those old kids fold out things, you'd open the flaps and, you know, it's a hyper object. So in a holographic sense, so those two points in time are connected. And, you know, to have a very intense DMT experience may actually then, there may be sort of reverberations in both directions. Yes. Through space-time. So things, you know, may happen earlier in your life from something that happens later.
Yeah. I've had that experience myself. I know what you're talking about there. These kinds of synchronicities or premonitions and this kind of thing seems to especially occur around a very intense spiritual experience. And it's almost as if that that thing is calling back to you from the future, echoing back into the present.
Yeah, it's like a strange attractor. Yeah.
So I do now want to talk about La Rosacita, which, as I mentioned, just blew me away. I was wondering what your take on that experience is now. When you look back on it, what do you think it was that took place there?
Well, I know exactly what happened there. You know, I met God, right? But I wouldn't personally use the word God, even though I do come from a Catholic background. A lot of people have trouble with the labels, which is why, basically, when I came out of the trans-linguistic experience, all I could say was, it's it. Because there was just this overwhelming entity that it didn't fill the space, it was the space. And, you know, I fully understand and grok and resonate with all these mystical touchings upon this same space throughout time of the white light void tunnel that we go to, or we go through this tunnel as we die. It's not just a tunnel, it's like a womb, you know, it's like this space that goes to this central core of the Godhead, and it just went deeper and deeper and on and on forever and ever, amen. But it felt to me, to use another metaphor, it felt like the large Super Hadron Collider of hyperspace. It wasn't just a tunnel, I could see very subtle energetic, like lightning storms around the round sort of circumference. It was a vibrational docking port. It was something that was reading my vibrational atomic structure, and it was opening my structure as I was merging into its wavefront and it was merging into me, and we were realizing we were both one. And it was beautiful, and it was awe-inspiring, and there was no fear, which is why I think I had the momentum I had, because I was just the drop rejoining the ocean. And I do not fear death, because I feel I have gone as far as I can go and bungee jump back. I've only done that experience that deeply twice, and both of them were recounted in the book, and one of them is in the film. And the other thing I think about that experience, I must say, you know, what I've really tried to do with that experience is to give a glimpse or a gleaning of what it was like visually and emotionally. It's not just the visuals, it's really the emotional journey. And it is all metaphor, and it is all very personal and idiosyncratic. And it actually was, you know, it was my most sacred experience ever. So by sharing that with the viewers, I am not trying to project. I'm not trying to say, this is God, you must believe my God. It's not about the big G. It's about what I believe is a valid hyperspatial geography which has an intelligence attached to it, which I believe not just as science, but as spiritual beings I'm interested in. And I think that frontier, that landscape exists. And I think about it often, you know, I really do. And it gives me hope, and it gives me connection. And I just feel that it's it was pretty massive. And I just want to, you know, clarify that I really don't want to project my isms on anyone, but I would encourage people to watch the film and to take their own learnings and reactions to it.
Great. And yet, although you don't want to call it God or influence other people's perceptions of what that might be, this did leave you with a distinct impression that there is an aspect of you that is immortal, that will survive physical death.
Yes, it did. It did. It's a bit of a linguistic sort of conundrum, though, because it really, like, I understood all the mystic terminology, you know, in very intimately once I've gone through the experience, because when they say this oceanic metaphor and that the drop rejoins the ocean, there is no individual consciousness in the ocean. It's a mesh network of individuality becoming a greater whole. So when the remembrance was happening that I was this thing, it wasn't a human remembrance. You know, it wasn't as if there was any I. I was erasing my I as I traveled further, deeper into it, forwards into it. I was losing myself. But at the same time, what I was gaining was remembrance that I was also not what I thought I was. And so, yes, I do believe. And it makes me actually think, this is what my intuition from that experience that I've gleaned, is that nature, they say, as above, so below in our chemical understanding. And we're looking at sciences like biomimicry and the applying the way that nature works. It seems to me that natural systems work in similar principles and similar rhythms at different scales of iteration. And so if we have something like the condensation cycle down here on Earth, and the literal, you know, raindrops coming down to Earth and then going into the ground and then coming back up again and rejoining the cloud mass, it's that cycle of water vapor. It seems to me that a very similar principle must be at work in the incarnation of souls, and that in the backwards form that I was rejoining the ocean, I can extrapolate from that that there is a rhythm and there is a natural process at work, and that gives me hope, and that gives me some understanding that the same principles that work down here of nature are working in there or up there. But I don't know about the survival of the ego or of the identity. Mm.
Was there any consciousness of your own identity at that time? It sounds like maybe there wasn't, but for example, were you... Does an individual maintain, say, a sense of humor? Are you aware of your physical body as you're going through this experience?
No. Really, all there was like an open screen of being... and a full presence. Basically, it was a samadhi state. It was a state of a full one point of consciousness. So there's no, you know, scratch your nose or think about something else or whatever. There's that single point of being, and all it's doing is being. It's just being in the presence of the Godhead and realizing that that is the core being. And so there's no lower ego demands or, you know, issues that are clouding that. And I must say, I have talked with some other journey people as well, some other shamanauts, I call us. You know, it's a very you know, similar experiences. Is that there's usually, if people have prepared and people are in a good emotional state and people are not interrupted, then it's not about the terrestrial baseline egoic bodily needs. It's really about letting go of all of that and just being fully present, like you are with a lover, you know? It's that presence that is required of us, that devotional presence. And that's why I really resonate with Rumi and Hafiz and a lot of the Sufi poets as well. I can glean from how they write and what they write and the relationship they had with the divine and the beloved, that that's another term I think is a very good one, the beloved, you know. It's not as evocative, perhaps, as the Godhead, but it's basically the same thing. The same qualities are present in that moment.
So since you mentioned some of these mystics, this experience you had is kind of the one that some of the real heavy hitters were trying to describe, people like Christ, Buddha, Mohammed, what have you. And I'm wondering, when you've had this kind of experience, which is common to some of these great mystics, is there any danger of ego inflation or getting a messianic complex afterwards, something like that?
Well, that usually seems to be what happens with a lot of the mystic-prophets, is that they run off and run to the hills and shout from the top of them. I guess I was lucky in a way that it happened to me. You know, it's chapter 7 of the book, so I was at the beginning, sort of in a way, of my longer shamanic journey in Peru, and I had to get back to work. You know, I was still on the trail, and I was really, I felt a duty of care to integrate not just my experience, but to get it down, to try to make it concrete and anchor the experience, to transmit it for the tribe. And so in a very similar sense, it's exactly the same archetype as the mystics you've described, and the same issues are at work, the same dynamics. But I guess I'm lucky that you know, I haven't gone off and founded a religion, and I'm not looking to do that. I'm just looking to share my experiences, and also to point out that what I've gleaned from my experiences is that they're not unique to me or to mystics of history, that these potentials lie within us. And you know, the DMT, 5-MeO-DMT, is a lot deeper level of the bardo, but some of the earlier levels are quite common to be experienced in shamanic journey work with ayahuasca or DMT or other entheogens. And what I'm really, you know, interested in and commenting on is the fact that there's a shamanic generation in the West. And it's not necessarily about these depth experiences. It's about finding the value in them and how to integrate these experiences to be of value to our communities, to how to do healing and how to help with illness, how to uncover the Western psyche's illnesses. And that doesn't always mean the deep 5-MeO journeys. It usually means, you know, using the ability to journey in a shamanic sense, to engage with our own unconscious, to engage with the tribe, and to try to help make the world a better place. Because when I had the 5-MeO DMT experience, it's as deep as you can go. If I had have kept going, it would have been fine, because it's just all fine, right? But it's not something you want to do all the time. Like, if I never did it again, it'd be there for me at the end, and that's okay. And so I'm not encouraging 5-MeO DMT use. I guess, as you've pointed out, like other mystics, I'm just another signpost on the historical trail saying it exists.
Very nice. So, Rack, now I want to backpedal a little bit and get more of a basic perspective on ayahuasca for the readers who might be new to this subject or who might just think it's some crazy drug. For those people, can you talk a little about how a person might benefit from using ayahuasca and how you personally have?
Yeah, I think it's good we have a very you know, well-rounded context to this discussion and this article, so it is grounded in ayahuasca and not too much focus on the DMT. It's almost as if the DMT is the gift inside the wrapper of the film, and let's let them discover that. Ayahuasca, what was your question again, the phrasing?
Just more of a basic perspective on how somebody might benefit from it, and what distinguishes it from drugs in the sense that Westerners think of drugs.
Sure. Well, the number one thing is that, you know, ayahuasca is an indigenous plant medicine of South America. It's been used by the curanderos or the healers or the medicine people all throughout South America for, they say, presumably thousands of years, as the anthropological record shows. And the number one thing about it is that it is a medicine. It's a purgative. It's not something that can be done recreationally, and it also has that historical lineage to these medicine people and to the right usage of it. And so Western academics and anthropologists and psychotherapists have sort of pointed out that the shorthand is that it's like a year's worth of psychotherapy in a night. And it's basically because what I was saying at the start, because it has a physical healing capacity. We know from the linking up of the brain activity again on that level. It's a purgative that is used by the Amazonian people who, you know, may be themselves subject to illnesses in the water or the air or things like that. And so it's a physical purgative, and it can take out physical bugs and things like that on that level. It also, what I feel, what is one of the most important facets of ayahuasca is that it really reveals yourself. You get to know yourself, and that is perhaps one of the most valuable things. Forget all the shamanic stuff, forget all the mystic stuff. Just on a psychological level, to have a night where you can be working with the medicine and what the medicine's doing in you, it's the harmine and harmaline in the ayahuasca vine itself is said to be very heart-opening. And so there's usually this this remembrance of love and this feeling of revisiting your loved ones on a mental level, at least. A lot of the issues and hurts and wounds and things that are in people's histories, they all come up for revisiting and for healing. And the best part about that is the plant isn't doing the healing. The spirit in the plant isn't doing the healing. The curandero isn't doing the healing alone. You're doing the healing because ayahuasca is helping you find yourself again. And that's really important to remember. You know, it's as shamanism is on the rise and the increase and people are drawn to it, they have to be discerning. They have to find the right place, the right practitioner, and they have to trust themselves. And ayahuasca can help reinstill that trust in yourself. And so what it's doing, once the physical body is healed and the mental and the emotional wounds are healed, then the capacity for the visionary component happens. Like in my first three or four ayahuasca ceremonies, I had no visions. And for the last 3 or 4 years in Australia, which is a very different modality in a sense than drinking ayahuasca in the jungles, but I rarely vision, usually because I haven't done a dieta enough, I haven't cleansed, I haven't been able to slow down enough, and my adrenals are always on, I'm very busy. But to have the time alone, just you in the jungle, you know, and to be away from civilization as we think of it, and to get in touch with your spirit, that can be very healing on a spiritual, emotional level, even if you don't have an illness. But it has proven to be efficacious with people with many illnesses and tumors and cancers and things like that. They're raising money at the moment for some cancer tests to do a double-blind study and, you know, the efficiency of ayahuasca with that. But, you know, the thing to remember, it's not just ayahuasca. It isn't a pill. It isn't recreational. It's a modality and a process that you engage with this plant medicine.
Okay, good. Now, I want to talk a little more about ayahuasca as a purgative, and in particular, as a catalyst for catharsis. That was something that I didn't see all that much of in your movie or your book. I'd love to hear more about maybe your experience or other people's experiences that you've seen getting things out, getting out the sick, getting out the bad stuff.
You don't remember all those vomiting scenes in the film?
I do remember the vomiting scenes, but I didn't hear too much in there about what personally you were cleansing from your soul. You see what I mean?
Well, it's very interesting on a level. Like, I mean, we've all got our issues and our hurts and things like that. But to a large degree, I don't think I have any huge issues that I was working on. Well, there's a few. Sometimes, here's the funny thing with the vomiting, and it's something which, you know, this can be an uncomfortable discussion for many people. People in the ayahuasca community, it's just like talking about farting. You know, it's not an issue because it's such a central part of the process, and people don't always vomit. You know, if you're very clean and have a vegetarian lifestyle, and you're energetically sort of clean, the vomiting is usually to help clear physical blockages and also, emotional blockages or things like that. So when people vomit, you know, myself included, there might be a physical purge, but what might be coming out is this energetic blockage that you may have in your energetic field or energy body that has been associated with a hurt or an illness or a wound, and that might be coming out and letting go with the physical vomit as well. So, you know, I had my own little personal things, I guess, I was working on, but nothing dramatic per se. I guess I wasn't the usual sort of cover story for ayahuasca of, like, you know, Westerner in need of healing going down to Peru. I was more going down as a seeker on a spiritual journey and to touch base with the spiritual aspects of that experience. But many, many people do, and I have, you know, heard many stories and witnessed many people doing prodigious vomits. And the funny thing is, there seems to be like 24 chambers to the stomach, and they all vomit up one after the other, and just like it's impossible because, you know, I learnt in the indigenous Shipibo style where you don't drink water during the ceremony, even as soon as you've drunk the ayahuasca, because you're not adding water to the mix and not adding, and, you know, having fasted during the day. And it seems pretty crazy when you've fasted for an entire day or so and not drunk any water, and still, when it comes to the vomit time of the night, there's 24 chambers of your stomach vomiting up all this water or something. They come from nowhere. Like, it's impossibly weird. I have heard stories where people say they vomit up, either objects or even, like, snakes. I had an experience under the influence of ayahuasca, not from my mouth physically with a snake, but coming out of my leg when I was healed. It could be a manifestation of this energetic issue, though, more than a physical thing. But the other thing to remember, it's like with alcohol poisoning. When you do purge, it feels wonderful. It really does. It's not a negative thing at all, because there is a release. There is a release of toxins and neurochemistry on that level, and a release of emotional and release of the build-up. Because quite often in ceremony, I will struggle. I will sit there and I'll breathe and I'll meditate and I will go, you know, like when you know you've got to go to the toilet but you don't want to go, and it goes on for ages, and you're like, no, I'm fine. But you can feel there's this queasiness of this thing, and, you know, hours can go by, and then I'll go like, you really got to go vomit, and you go vomit and you feel great because it's a release. And this is actually part of it. It's like the ability to release and let go, to surrender, is definitely part of the ayahuasca experience on all levels, physical, mental, emotional, energetically, yeah.
So, Rak, how do the indigenous people that you've spoken with feel about the use of ayahuasca among Westerners in general? Do they usually feel that Westerners are approaching this with the proper level of respect and with sacred intent?
There is a real clash of cultures between Westerners and indigenous peoples of South America when it comes to ayahuasca, and many people are really approaching it with respect and integrity, but there's also an industry that's being built up over the last 20 years or so, and it's become very fast-moving and dynamic in the last 5 to 10 years. And so on one level, you know, my shorthand for this is, you know, Peru has seen many booms, and there's on some level a sort of cultural imperialism going on, where at the turn of the 20th century they had an oil boom, a rubber boom, and then, you know, in the mid-20th century they had a rubber boom, and then now they've got an ayahuasca boom. And in each case there's a valuable commodity that is native to the land, and Westerners are coming to engage with it, you know, some might say exploit it. Ayahuasca's not as directly labelled as exploiting, but there is issues around money, and there's issues around Western influence on lodges and Western tourism. But on the other level, you know, a lot of the native people in Peru, at least, are very poor, and the role of the shaman or the medicine person was being culturally erased by globalization. You know, it's a very arduous role to be a medicine person in that culture. It takes decades of training and of withdrawal from the world, of abstinence from many, many things, to achieve the sensitivity to be able to hear the plants and speak with the plants and work with them as medicines. And so, you know, that was a role that was in danger. And some people argue that this isn't true, but, you know, from people I spoke to in Iquitos, they said, look, really, this is where it was going. Shamanism would have died out, except it became valuable. It became so valuable, the Westerners came in with the money, they wanted the healing, and so all of a sudden, everyone and their dog now says they're a shaman and puts up their shingle for the tourism trade. There are still some very good people, some very integral practitioners working there. In general, they find there's two types of Westerners. Westerners coming in search of healing for a direct issue or problem, whether physical or mental or spiritual, and then basically seekers, who I think are the larger majority, who are coming because they have some undefined unease, some disconnection with the Western material world, and are really seeking a connection through ayahuasca and through shamanism to the planet and to the web of life, to this anchoring of spirituality and of the material world, and of, you know, getting back to the earth. I feel that the whole green movement, the whole sort of permaculture movement, and the whole sustainability movement is has been directly influenced by the changing consciousness of the 60s, and now we're coming full circle to the deep green movement, which is through shamanism and through modalities like ayahuasca, not solely ayahuasca, but, you know, plant entheogens. When you connect to the planet and when you feel the planet and the web of life as a visceral entity, as something you can tangibly feel in your heart, you don't want to make war with the planet anymore. We can't convert people to a green meme, but people can feel the planet, and once they do, you're never the same. So there seems to be the planet herself, I feel, is secreting these substances as exopheromones for humans to engage with to bring us back to the garden.
I love it. In your experience, can Westerners get as much out of this medicine as indigenous people can?
We've got to remember, indigenous people themselves would go to a practitioner, and the practitioner in at least the Shipibo tribe would be the one who drank the ayahuasca on their behalf. And then he would look into their energetic body, he would remove any sorcery done to them, and so forth and so on. So indigenous peoples, they do drink ayahuasca too in different tribes and mestizo traditions, but for them it's direct medicine. It's like going to the doctor. It's like going to the doctor and sitting in an all-night ceremony, coughing, vomiting, spluttering, and the next day shaking hands, thank you, here's your chicken, we'll see you next week if you've got an issue to work on. It's nothing romantic about it, there's nothing mystical about it, well, there is, but essentially it's going to a doctor to get healed. That's why indigenous people go. Western people will get out of it as much as they choose to put into it. If they do it with respect and integrity, learn the ways of indigenous people, you know, try not to be, you know, naive tourists about it, then I think that they can get a lot out of it. And, you know, if you do, you definitely need to do the dieta. You need to put the nine yards in. The more you cleanse your body and your mind and your soul, then the more you can be a firm vehicle for the ayahuasca to fill and to open up these spaces of healing and enlightenment.
Okay. Now, have you personally been able to integrate the shamanic state of consciousness into your life as a Westerner?
Well, you know, it's integrated to a large sense because I'm engaging with talking about it, and also I continue the shamanic path with my own spiritual practice as often as I can. But I'm also in the 9-to-5 to a degree, and I've got family, and yeah, there's a slight sadness in me that, you know, I have responsibilities and commitments that I am upholding as I also walk on my spiritual path. But I do realize it's chop wood, carry water. It's you know, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is a mountain. It's like the whole point of the spiritual experience is to deepen our capacity for spirit in the physical experience. and then to bring that into our lives, into our communities, into our families and our job, and to be better people, you know, and to live in right relationship with the planet and our fellow human beings. So on that level, I am consciously conscious of trying to do the best with everyone I meet and to being open to that and to helping spread the knowledge of where I've come from and the experiences I've had without projecting them on people, but to be the best person that I can, yeah.
Okay. Now, there was a part of your book where somebody commented that you were hitting the ayahuasca possibly a little harder than might be necessary. What made you decide to really just go for it in the way that you did?
I don't remember that part of the book. You know, I had no idea what I was getting into. I basically went over to write a 3,000-word article, which became a 500-page book and now a film. But I also realized, as we talked before about the prophetic dream, and so many things happened in the weeks preceding the trip, that basically, miraculously, one step after another, the path revealed itself and I was supported to go on the journey. And now looking, we talked about non-linear time, and now I understand why. It's like, the journalism was a cover story. It was a cover story for me to go and to journal, but it was really, it was a pilgrimage. It was a spiritual pilgrimage that I went on that I never would have been able to either afford or to convince myself to go on if I hadn't have been working. That's the type of person I am. I don't take holiday. I take holy days. You know what I mean? And my work is my spiritual practice. It's learning more about, you know, the shamanic realm, hyperdimensionality, the planetary Gaian sort of mainframe, and integrating that. It's really helping nurture Western shamanic culture. That's what I feel at the moment is my role, but I can't do that without my own spiritual practice being at the core of that. So the journey I went drinking with over 24 different curanderos and the DMT experiences, it was just the path, man. And I just every day would wake up and would go, right, who's the next curandero that we should drink with? I was with John Bowman, who's in the film, and Vance Gallet for at least the first you know, few weeks of that journey. And we would just tick off the best known curanderos of Iquitos, and we would try them out. And then we would integrate them into our media. Vance was taking photos for his exhibition, and John was doing audio recordings of the Icaros, and I was doing the journalism. So it felt like our duty, you know, as integral media makers to keep going. And on that path, it was very exciting, you know. It was very exciting to keep learning. It was fresh, virgin territory, and so there was an excitement around the next ayahuasca session and the next session.
Now, does there come a point where you set the ayahuasca aside, or is this a lifelong practice?
Well, you know, there's big gaps between cups. I have drunk irregularly over the last 4 years or so, and I think, I tell you what, when I go more than a month or so without some type of ego-dissolving experience, and perhaps I should just be learning to meditate, you know, that might be a whole lot easier route. But I do feel the cultural accrued gunk building up in me, you know, the stress and the sort of metatextual or metaphysical awareness that I'm like, oh, here I am just on baseline frequency. It's like, oh, you know, you've got to do it. This is where it's at. The baseline realm is spiritual as well. And humans change their consciousness every day, all the time. You know, not just, you know, coffee and alcohol and inebriants and psychedelics and media. You see, I'm in New York City now, and everywhere I go to a cafe, 60 people are on their laptops or iPhones or phones. They have conversations, and they pause between conversations. They look down at their phones, and it's like everyone is in an altered state all the time. Like, you know, reality is an altered state. But some altered states tune us in to the sacredness of our being. And so I do feel the need to pursue that sacredness ongoingly. And I do perceive ayahuasca or the entheogenic modality to be part of that in my future, yes.
Okay. So you've described in many of your ayahuasca sessions having gone into spontaneous glossolalia and hand gestures. I was wondering if these experiences have given you an appreciation or somehow changed your perspective on the use of mantras and mudras in spiritual practice?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. You know, it's something I'd really like to explore more, but I have definitely had some DMT experiences, ayahuasca, but mainly DMT, where, you know, I was assuming mudras and hand positions and the glossolalia as well. I think the glossolalia feels to me like when I have ingressed into a higher dimensional frequency. When we say higher dimensions, what we mean, I feel there's a more excited vibrational rate of that dimension. So there's a density of vibration which is heavier and more dense, not in a lower density, but it's more excited state. And so that vibration, when it comes into the physical shell, has to release itself through sound. And the reason I glean that is also because I was getting empathic overlays with the insect kingdom in many of my jungle experiences in ayahuasca, and I was hearing them. And what I was grokking was that they don't just sing because they want to sing. If you've ever heard whatever the collective noun for like cicadas or different insects are, it's like a battalion of them. They create this, it's like monks singing, and they're singing a chant, and the chant is a holy chant. It's vibration. They're not singing, they're opening the portal through their bodies to channel higher vibrational energy, release it into the ecosystem, and activate the other species. We do know in biology this is what the interspecies interdependence does. One species will cascade into another. And so I was, you know, grokking all this from hearing the insects and having my own glossolalia experiences of higher dimensionality ingressing and voicing itself through me. And so I feel that's what's happening with the sound level. And the mudras, I think, is something even more enigmatic. And I'm not exactly sure, but I feel that there's some type of entity, and it could even just be that the dimensionality we just discussed, the vibrational dimensionality itself, when it intersects with the human energetic template, starts to move the body in certain forms. Again, I think the word portal is a very important one. I really feel that there's an influx and overlap between higher dimensionality and whatever intelligence is in that. And I think when we think of entities, we think of physical entities, even if they're in a dimensional space. I highly suspect the realm itself as a vibrational frequency has some type of sentience or intelligence, and when it intersects with our templates, it comes out in these forms, which are ancient mystical forms, because what we're doing with our bodies then, we are assuming a energetic form to anchor energy. Excuse me. And by anchoring energy, that higher dimensionality radiates just again through the ecosystem, through us. But I've had experiences where I was basically possessed by entities and moving my hands like a motor, and it wasn't me at all. Something was moving me, and I think what it was doing is it was trying to open a portal. It was trying to do something with the vehicle of my body. So you've got to be careful.
Yeah, does that concern you at all? I mean, is there any concern that whatever entity that was might still be with you, or what its intentions were in the first place?
Yeah, you have to be careful, and you have to have discernment, and you know, I think we should take on a little of the magical paradigm and have a protected circle, do a banishing ritual at the end, do cleansing and smudging, and even see expert practitioners who can help remove any passengers that crop up. I think, you know, I did hear Dr. Jacques Mabit was at the MAPS conference in April 2013, and we had a community discussion around ayahuasca with about 200 people, and he said he's worked at the Takawasi Clinic in Tarapoto for 20 years dealing with addicts and curing addiction with ayahuasca, and in his experience, the number one problem we face in the West is that we do not believe that entities are real. We do not believe that they are independent from our subconscious or manifestations of our mind. And because of that, we don't take precautions, we don't believe in them, and we are just, it's basically like we're having, you know, unprotected sex with cosmic intelligence.
So it's a matter of learning the rules and learning how to protect oneself. One thing I've heard a lot about is with these entities is doing some sort of surgery or putting some kind of implant in people's heads. What do you think is going on there?
Well, that's chapter 18. I had that as well. Look, I remember I interviewed Guillermo Arevalo, who's a very famous curandero who was in the movie Blueberry or Renegade by Jan Koonen, and he was saying that, and he was saying entities, but he was basically describing aliens, what we would consider, you know, creatures like the Greys or what the UFO mythology is evolving. And he was saying that he goes up through the dimensional realms and he encounters them, and he's been to their spaceships, and, you know, they do operations and they're doctors too, and there's stuff going on there. And I don't know. I mean, it does overlap and intersect with that UFO type of culture. And I mean, really, it's not any less fantastical than shamanic culture. They're just different labels for the same experiences, I believe. And I don't know enough of who they are, what they're doing. But in my personal experience with entities that did something to me, again, it was like a crystal or something put in my head at some really weird M.C. Escher angle of reality. And it didn't feel evil or necessarily bad, but it was definitely cold and sort of non-loving. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think that, again, like our previous question, the more we traverse the terra incognita, the invisible landscape, without a map and without knowing who the natives are and what their allegiances are like and what's in it for them, then the more problems we have, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's why I've been, for the most part, holding off at exploring the territory somewhat, but at a bit of a distance while explorers like you go in there and make some maps. You know, along those lines, I mean, obviously there's no question ayahuasca has just been an incredible catalyst for healing and spirituality for a vast amount of people. At the same time, when I hear about things like spirit possession and entity abduction, stuff like that, I sometimes wonder, is this a domain that is better left alone?
You know, to extend my metaphor from before about unprotected sex and the cosmic ecology, McKenna said this as well. He said, you know, to go to the grave without having a sexual experience is almost to deny what nature has built into us, to reveal these dimensions of being and this ability to connect with other human beings and to love. And to feel, you know, the energetic sort of nature of that. And it's no different with the shamanic realm or the dimensional realities this opens up. This is part of our birthright. It's part of our potential. In many cultures in times past, it wasn't just medicine people that serviced, you know, a village. It seemed to be that, I believe, you look at Aboriginal Dreamtime, they seem to be saying that there's a state of consciousness that we used to have in a different world age, and they believe it's coming back, that we all can enjoy or we all can interact with. It's something which we do need to be careful about, just like with sex, you know, but it's like it's something which not only exists, it's built into us by nature, and that we are embedded in this larger galactic ecosystem. And so for those people who really understand that, it's not just a metaphor, you know, it's like the fact that this larger reality is reality, it exists, that once the curtain's pulled back, I think we have to carefully and professionally and with integrity, those of us who choose to, explore this realm. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you had a nice quote where you talk about reality being made of language, along the lines of McKenna. There's a quote, when you say a word, we make a vibration, we mint it crisp, we bring it down. Can you explain that a little more?
I'm really glad you picked up on that. For me, that was some... See, this is the point. For me, it's not just... I don't feel like I'm a glorifier of these experiences. I feel like I went in as a gonzo journalist, but I hope as a damn good gonzo journalist, to really try to capture the essence of these experiences and the realms that they open up. And what I was grokking about this... Because it's all vibration. Everything, this is what the quantum physicists tell us. And so to actually physically experience the realm of vibration through these modalities is to go swimming, you know, in the fields of the Lord. And because it's vibration, when I first made the sound, I made a little, oh, you know, as you hear in the film, we've got the original outside footage. But on my interior landscape in my journey, when I heard that sound, I could almost sort of see, but almost like feel this ripple from the sound interfacing with the ripple coming forward from the Super Hadron Collider Mystic Godhead Tunnel thing. And then it was bouncing back, and there was an empathic pulse of like, yes, 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 make sound, you know, like it's all about sound, because that's how you travel in there. And so when you see in the film the very, very, very extreme translinguistic glossolalic climax, you might not understand it. It's not just the outside flesh body, you know, screaming. It's actually what I was trying to do was to honor that that pulsing from deep Godhead to say to make sound, and to give it my best sound, my most honored, my most sacred sound, you know? So that was my Tarzan cry. That was my most sacred sound of glossolalia back to the Godhead. And in that process, it felt to me, and this is the very important thing I've learned over the years, nature builds in us not just the intellect and logic, it builds in imagination and intuition. And in these realms, we need all the capacity nature has given us. Henry Bergson was a famous philosopher of the 20th century, late 19th century. He did a lot of philosophizing and work around this capacity of intuition to connect with these type of states of being where logic doesn't do it on its own. So my intuition, and the thing is with intuition in these realms, I don't just go, oh, I think it might be this. You know, it's a knowing. Intuition is a word which has been debased in Western culture and logic culture. Intuition basically for me means you know. It's like knowing at a distance, you know. And so I felt what was happening when I said a word, any word, is I'm creating a vibration. And the inside of that vibration, it's like a chocolate with a milk center or something, you know, a creamy center. The center, the good bit, is what I'm trying to communicate. So if I'm trying to say so like love or respect or you know, or whatever emotional concept or naming thing, there's an energy attached to how I feel about that thing or the feeling of that thing that is somehow linguistically, topographically embedded in the word. And I'm just using more words to try to cluster the meaning here, because again, in translinguistic experiences, it's not about going, it's about anchoring emotional semantic meaning with these words. And so this was all happening in this state, so it's pretty hyper condensed, but for me that's one of my favorite little bits in the book. I'm glad you picked up on that.
Yeah, it was really interesting to me. I think that just about wraps it up, Rack. Maybe I'll just ask at this point, what have I missed? What do you want to talk about that we haven't discussed?
Well, look, I'll just to give it a bit more of a mainstream grounding. You know, I quote this academic in the book called Roy Ascott, who has these three. He coined the term. There's validated reality, there's virtual reality, and there's vegetal reality. And I think it's a very good little phrase to help understand that what we're describing here isn't necessarily mystic or even the word shamanic, or something that is so out there that we cannot comprehend or isn't relevant to the average person. I'm not saying, you know, these shamanic realms are for everyone, but what I am saying through this analogy is that as we've entered the 21st century and we're seeing more and more augmented reality and data overlays, and basically the human species is changing so rapidly now through our relationship with technology, and on a very broad scale, the bigger waves of technology and of computing and of the internet and of communication technology are basically recreating the neural networks and the distributed consciousness. We're becoming a hive mind. And so what that shows to me is that we're modeling, we're basically recreating on the outside what nature does on the inside. And so that we're there's something happening very interestingly now, very dynamically now in the 21st century as a species. And for me, that techno-shamanic sort of language and these realms I'm talking about in the vegetal reality are directly connected to the technological reality. So I feel that the, maybe not the average person yet, but everyone is basically embracing altered states, and I feel that's the shockwave for integration of this natural vegetal reality, which has always been there and is coming full circle.
Wonderfully put. Anything else?
I'm about done. Thank you. Thank you so much, Damon.
Yeah, another fantastic talk. I really liked it, and I can't wait to see the movie again. I'm fired up about that.